Hey, hi, Brendan.
Hi, ho, Alan.
The Not a Thing podcast is back. It's good. 116 of these things, plus a couple here and there. I think we'll stop counting those eventually. But those extra episodes are now, what is it? It's still like just slightly 2% of the entire episodes that we've done. The kind of extra.
Those are outliers.
Yeah, yeah. It's the majority of episodes kind of
have real numbers.
Yes. But it's still fun to do. It's still great to do these. If you're interested in being part of the show, we're happy to have you on the show. We've been saying this kind of as we go. We haven't really had a guest in a little while, so like to kind of put some more feelers out to make that work. But it's really a fun time. Anyone who's been on the show has always said that they want to come back. So maybe we should just ping someone who's been on the show before.
Start cycling back through. Rehashing old plots. I mean, visiting old friends. That's the one.
Well, one of our old plots or old friends is the segment we affectionately call Fuck the Police. We have a brand new story this week about something that I think we've sort of talked about a little bit, but it came out in a New York Times article this week, I believe, about police evidence seizures. And this is this falls under the technical term, I guess, of civil forfeiture. And it's the process where the police can seize property that is related to a crime, whether that crime is convicted or not. So suspected criminals' property can be seized during that operation. So, for example, if you are being pulled over for drug possession, your car could be impounded and actually just, you know, straight up seized by the police and then sold at auction, you know, after the fact, before your conviction, you know, actually takes effect, if you're even convicted at all. Now, at some point, you can potentially sue to get that property back, or at least money for that property. But it's
the burden of proof is entirely on you,
right?
And it's not run by a judge; it's run by a cop.
Yeah. So it's not wonderful sounding as it is, but apparently it's been going up in recent years, and there was more of a kind of under the covers look at this using, you know, people who are speaking on, you know, on behalf of active policemen or whatever. And it sounds like there are genuine wish lists about what cops are trying to seize. And it's kind of surprising or interesting, because it sounds very legitimate. It sounds very much like it's not a, like, let's get everything we can get. It's targeting specific things like big screen TVs or cars, but not things like jewelry, which might have sentimental value and be very, you know, something that someone would sue for. Whereas something like a TV, is it worth hiring a lawyer to process all that stuff and argue on your behalf for a TV that's only worth, like, you know, a grand? And that's where it comes into. There's like this, I guess, quote unquote, sweet spot of stuff. And they become things that the police just seize. And that's totally not a thing.
It's legal extortion.
Yeah.
They take your shit, and then you have to prove that it shouldn't have been taken, and then you have to pay them to get it back.
Yeah. Yeah. It's more than kind of surprising. In the article, there's a quote about a police department that they said something like they're very proud of their civil forfeiture department because it generates revenue for the force. And seizing criminal assets, I feel, should not be treated as part of like a budget.
Well, and the spin they try and put on it, where they say all you hear is the other side of the story of we're taking everybody's stuff and getting money for it, but you don't hear what we get to use that money for, you know, combating crime and buying more equipment. Like, that's the argument.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing. I mean, especially when, you know, married with all of the militarization of police things that we've talked about over the podcast, where it's like, okay, so they're taking civil goods, right? Stuff from people, and then they're also buying kind of military level things. It's like there's this whole enterprise here kind of involved. It's, you know, what happened to policing? You know, it's in the name, people. I think it's yet another example of kind of overextension of the charter of police. So again, keep an eye on it. Be ever vigilant. Do what you can. Keep your head down. But also be aware that cops have a lot of power, and it's still an ongoing thing in pretty much every district. So that's our mostly our section. Although we're actually coming back to a lot of quote unquote old friends this week on the show. Another story from days yore was actually from our first episode about when we talked about Bitcoin and kind of dark nets a little bit. We talked about the Silk Road. Well, apparently last week the successor to the Silk Road was shut down. Now,
the cleverly titled Silk Road 2.
Yeah. They could have maybe been a little more more devious about the successor's name, so as not to make it so easy to find. But I mean, you know, whatever. It obviously they were banking on name recognition for that one, but. We talked a little bit about it when the original Silk Road was shut down. This time, I believe the way it worked was the original one was shut down, and then the guy kind of in charge of it, his name was the Dread Pirate Roberts, set up the second one almost immediately, and it was successful for at least a little while. But it, and then I believe two other quote-unquote darknet markets were also shut down. They're called darknet markets, and I feel like we've not really talked about that on the show, but they use anonymizing services to have kind of a hosting. So they'll use things like Tor and VPN and things like that to create a network space which isn't tied to a physical location, or at least obviously. And so I thought it was funny that, it was novel. What's the right word? Interesting that the FBI's project to catch the darknets was called Onimus, as in, you know, the opposite of anonymous. It's pretty good. I mean,
the killer thing is that they had law enforcement had somebody undercover working for them before the site even went up.
Right. So that was the
beginning.
So that was the big get in this is that a lot of people were really worried because shutting down a thing that uses anonymizing services, you know, casts doubt on, you know, how anonymizing any of these services are. But from what I understand, and you know, what you're saying corroborates it, is that the sites were taken down because they had someone on the inside. And so, to the best of my knowledge, those anonymizing services are still, you know, good and useful at anonymizing people. But the you know, it also just goes to show that, you know, sometimes it's not technology that that is your problem if you're trying to keep something secret, or if you're trying to do something. It's not necessarily a technological fix or a technological kind of method of attack. Sometimes it's just, you know, knowing the right people. It's all
sometimes
about who you
just
know.
You just need a Johnny Utah.
It's like that thing about, you know, password hacking. It's like you don't need to hack passwords to get into a system. You just have to have a very convincing voice when you call someone and say, "Hi, my name's Alan from IT. How can I help you? Oh, can you give me your password while I'm trying to debug your problem?" It's using those powers for evil, folks. So we bid the Silk Road 2 adieu. I think it's very likely there will be a 3 or even a 4 kind of coming up. I think dealing with the dark nets and the demand for the things that were sold on them, I think can be dealt with in a different way than necessarily seizing property and shutting things down. But, you know, in the meantime, you know, keep those passwords strong.
Password strength in all things.
Yeah. Passwords are a thing, and strong passwords are a really big thing.
And if your password gets cracked, don't just add some other digit to the end of the same thing. People keep wanting to do for some reason.
Are you a password fan? Do you have like a pretty good method for creating passwords?
Yeah, let me explain it exactly. No. Yes, I do.
Yeah. Yeah, my password algorithm is pretty good. I think it's I still think there should be better ways of doing it than just alphanumeric passwords, but it requires more work on pretty much everybody's part to make that happen. Like I really like the idea of passwords as pictures. I know my bank does it, where you have kind of a two-stage login, and it's not used for the actual password, but it's used as a kind of secondary challenge to say, like, is this the picture you chose and the phrase you chose that when you set up your account? And it's just as a secondary thing, because for all you know, the username and password fields on your bank's website could just be coming from any website. But if they also are able to duplicate the like keys, essentially, that you've picked on the way in, it's a little more interesting. And I think remembering like a picture is very it triggers a different kind of memory pattern than trying to remember a password. And I just hate those the password recovery questions, because so many of those things can be actually looked up if you're, you know, at all savvy. It's like, oh, I could look up the city where you were born, and I could probably look up your mother, and your mother might have her maiden name on her Facebook account, so I can get that information too. So I'm not saying use fake information for all of those, but let's just say it might be a thing. Yeah, it's I think passwords are a way to do it, and I think having some amount of biometric data is interesting, but I don't quite trust biometric data yet. And the big deal with biometric data is if that stuff is actually compromised, you kind of can't change your password in that case.
Nope.
Not without serious amounts of, I guess, surgery or something. Yeah. I don't know. Two-factor authentication? It's pretty good. It's not bad in the meantime. It's a little annoying, but as kind of methods go, that's the one I approve.
Indeed.
But in any case, strong passwords are a thing. It's just another reminder. We probably talk a little bit too long about passwords. But if you want someone that has spent a long time on something, we found an article this week about the Reddit front page and kind of an analysis of it. So what happens is there's a someone who I believe is a programmer, I'm pretty sure.
Someone with too much time on his hands.
Well, he had the good fortune to have a thing that he had written make it to the front page of Reddit. And he went and found it fascinating how it got to the front page, because I guess there is an algorithm about how stuff gets there. And he went to great lengths to discover the nuances of this algorithm, because it's not just upvotes and downvotes. There's a weighting algorithm, or weighting, not time weighting, but weighting like W-E-I-G-H-T weighting. There's a weighting factor about certain subreddits and how they get stuff promoted to the front page, and a lot deeper set of algorithms. And it's a very long article about how stuff gets to the front page of Reddit. And it was actually too long. I actually didn't want to read it all. I still bookmarked it, and we talked about it being on the show. But I think the amount of time spent on getting this article put together, while interesting, is kind of not a thing. It's just Reddit, people. Come on.
I mean, Reddit is already enough of a time suck without having to add an analysis.
Yeah, it's like meta Reddit at this point.
It's already like turning on the water hose of the internet and then sticking your face in front of it.
Yeah, yeah. It does have some interesting points, and I think the thing that it exposes is more of how that kind of thing could be exploited, and in which case, if that algorithm is exploited in any kind of big and meaningful way, they're going to change the algorithm, which kind of will invalidate that amount of time spent to figure that out. So I feel like it's the kind of thing that probably should be more ephemeral. And it's interesting that he reverse engineered it. But in terms of, you know, how to get on the front page of Reddit, it's not like super helpful. I think you'd have more luck just taking pictures of like cats in shelters, and eventually you will get one that makes it.
So many cats. So many cats.
The internet is fueled by little cats and stuff. But speaking of the internet, also back to a story that we've kind of talked about in the past, and one that we're probably going to talk about for quite a while, is the internet and net neutrality. And there's some interesting developments in the last week about net neutrality. We've talked about it on the show before. I mean, I think it's clearly established net neutrality is a thing. But this last week, President Obama issued a statement specifically to the FCC about net neutrality. And the FCC is led by an appointee of the president, but it acts as an independent body. So in theory, it could reject the president's statement. But it's interesting because the president's statement is actually, we think, on the side of the good guys. And it's promoting net neutrality, not kind of bowing to what are clearly ISP and carrier pressures about kind of creating fast lanes and slow lanes on the internet and making throttling kind of a thing. So the real interesting kind of way that this is fixed is not to just say we shouldn't have this. It's actually urging the FCC to reclassify the internet, including mobile internet. So internet, you know, bandwidth available to phones, but also internet available via ISPs to everyone. But reclassifying the internet as a utility, which means that there are things like universal levels of service and a lot more protections about what you can and can't do, specifically not throttling the internet, not blocking access to things based on the carriers. And it kind of puts the, it still keeps the ecosystem around of carriers and ISPs, but it changes how all of those things kind of shake out. And there's been a lot of kind of reaction to this in general. Pretty much all ISPs have universally kind of panned this as a thing. Interestingly, an ISP that we've talked about on the air before, Sonic.net, which is an ISP in California, kind of in the Bay Area, has gotten kind of a lot of notoriety for this, for actually coming out on the side of the president and reclassifying the internet as a utility. It's really, I think, kind of the right side of history if you're going to look at it this way. I want to say it's Finland that classified the internet as a basic human right. Now, I don't know if I would go as far as that about the internet, but I also
think it may not be official, but people feel that way.
Oh, sure, right. I mean, there was a joke image that was going around where they took Maslow's hierarchy of needs, that pyramid of, you know, food, the things that you absolutely need. So, like, you need food and shelter and et cetera, et cetera. And then what someone did was they put at the base of the pyramid in pen, they wrote Wi-Fi underneath. So I think it is the kind of thing where the internet has become such an important thing. I'm not about to say that it needs to be kind of universally accessible in a free way, but it's certainly something that should be protected, you know, very, very vigilantly,
vigilantly.
There we go. That's the word I'm looking for. Vigilantly about access and kind of how it operates. It really needs to be something that is kind of outside of a lot of the commercial interests, I think.
It's still a young enough technology that we're still figuring all this stuff out.
Yeah.
And government moves slowly as it is. I mean, we've had energy and telephones for over 100 years. So, you know, that stuff's already in place. That's been accepted as a public utility.
Mm-hmm.
Internet has not been around that long.
Yeah, so I think it will go through the like kind of growing pains figuring that out, but it's amazing how much money has been spent on this by ISPs just to kind of manage the kind of perception of it, and then the direction by Congress and by lawmakers. It's really it's clearly a kind of big pile of money that's available in shaping how the internet is delivered and how it works. And it really is something that we as citizens have to be able to scrutinize and look at in a more rational way. And I think classifying it as a utility is a really good step in that direction, at least because we are still figuring it out, and we are still trying to get a handle on how everything it works by putting like restrictions and blocks and kind of directional things on top of the internet. It stifles its kind of growth and utility. That's why we want it to be a utility. I mean, we want to find all the ways that we can use it in a way that doesn't hinder it as we're finding those things out. And so there's so many more advancements that we've yet to really unlock. I mean, the Internet of Things is something that we've talked about kind of a bit on the show, and that really is just starting to get off the ground. And having kind of a free and open field for that to figure itself out in absence of a lot of regulation, I think is better. I think there probably should be some regulation, and clearly it shouldn't be free. People should be remunerated for, you know, providing those kinds of services and everything. But at the same time, making or shaping it in a way that is purely commercial or purely for commercial gain and interest, you know, definitely will hinder how the internet kind of shakes out, and the ISPs that are currently against reclassifying it as a utility and against net neutrality, I think are doing it wrong. But I mean, they really need they really need all of us to say so, and for them to actually start hearing it. So hopefully that'll kind of work out. I think the FCC doesn't, I don't know what their timeline is for kind of opening up a rule to kind of figure that out, or otherwise kind of be more definite about it. I know they've extended kind of the public comment period a couple times, and it's still something that's that even they're trying to figure out. So again, something to keep watch on, something that we're keenly aware of. The internet and net neutrality continue to be a thing for us, and hopefully for more people than just us.
Yes.
We're slowly kind of reining in the kind of trip down memory lane, and we're actually gonna just look back. We have an update about a story we talked about last week. We talked a little bit about how it was election day and there were some all sorts of changes coming through based on new laws around the midterm elections. And one of the things we joked about was kind of the intersection between the states that have allowed gay marriage and the states that have allowed the legalization of pot, or the decriminalization of it, at least for medical purposes. And someone went and made an infographic showing all of those like intersections. So we'll link it in the story. I think talking about essentially a Venn diagram on an audio podcast may not be the most compelling thing, but
the point is you don't want to be the last state.
Yeah.
And there's a list of them.
yeah, it's a short list, but it's a list. So take a look at those, see where you stand, or see where you would like to visit, and you know, vote with your dollars.
It kind of sucks to live in a red state if you like to smoke weed or be gay.
Yeah, it's still something that you know, it's one of those being on the right side of history things, I think. And this one might be one that you might want to get on the right side of history for earlier rather than later. We'll see. In kind of other news, the being on necessarily right side of kind of nature's technology gap has gotten a little more interesting. There was kind of the one of the skills of other animals in this world is sonar and echolocation, and I've always found this really fascinating. That bats and whales and a bunch of other animals use sonar, and not in a like I'm listening for things passive way, but actively making a noise, and then the way it echoes back to the bat, their brain can then figure out where things are, at least in a, you know, kind of rudimentary way. And I feel like that kind of concept is fairly well known, but something that came out this week was that not only do bats do that in a way that they're able to kind of locate and see where things are in the dark, especially, but it's There's actually tones that are not specifically for echolocation, but specifically to jam other bats. And so I guess bats will operate at a frequency that's very specific to them. And then other species, they emit a noise which essentially can mess up other species' echolocation, creating kind of an advantage if you're kind of hunting for bugs or shelter or essentially just trying to not hit a tree. It's this, there's a kind of arms race built into to bats anyway. And the article goes further in this, talking about how there are bugs that will emit frequencies that are similar to bats in order to kind of throw them off or be avoided, you know, because they don't want to be eaten by the bats either. And this kind of stuff is fascinating to me. I love the how there's this whole kind of essentially extra spectrum of kind of information and noise. I mean, one of the things that's talked about a lot is you know, especially with the FCC and everything about that, is there is a finite spectrum of transmissions that can happen, because there's only so much bandwidth, there's only so many kind of frequencies in kind of a radio wave kind of spectrum to do like cell phone traffic and internet and all that kind of stuff, TV. And then it's funny because that is a limited spectrum. That spectrum also includes all this stuff that nature is also kind of spewing out into the world to do stuff like location, finding things, finding mates, finding food. You know, the spectrum is very, very crowded. And so
I think that bats, this whole bat scenario, it should be used by Pixar. Should make a bat movie.
That would be
bats, yeah. Aerial dogfighting sonar. It'd be crazy.
That would be cool. I think, yeah, I really hope Pixar is picking up more kind of new stuff. I know they just released, or they just announced that there's going to be a fourth Toy Story movie in, I want to say, 2017. And I'm all for Toy Story. I loved it. I love the world that they've built, but you gotta hope that they have more kind of new stuff coming. I mean, everything, or not everything, there's a lot of sequels out in the world already, and I think there can be good sequels and bad sequels, but being new, it is more of a risk, but I think it's more interesting kind of in the long run. I mean, just
if they can make Ratatouille, I feel like they should be able to make a movie about bats.
Yeah. Yeah. I especially with Disney behind it. If they learned nothing from releasing Guardians of the Galaxy, it's that the public wants kind of new stuff too. So hopefully not all sequels, but how did we get on this track from bats?
Because I think it's a great idea for a movie.
Yeah, it is a good idea. It is a good idea. I think it also has interesting possibilities for how to produce the movie. I mean, you can do a lot of stuff with sound, where it's just sound. I mean, I don't mean necessarily telling the movie through sound, but it would be nice, maybe even for just one sequence, to have kind of a completely sightless kind of moment. I always thought that was
a bad eye view.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like Riddick.
Yes, let's make it exactly like Riddick.
There should be more Riddick. I think that's what we've taken from this. I don't even know that there would be a sequel, I guess, but that's a sequel I'm fine with.
Yeah, well, they could always make it, you know, yet another kind of timeline offshoot for Riddick, right? I mean, why not?
I want him to go get his revenge on the Necromongers. You keep what you kill.
Well, if we get anything from that, it'll definitely be in space. So one more story this week is about the Rosetta Project. And when I think Rosetta, I think Rosetta Stone, but this is actually not at all Rosetta Stone related. This is, and I mean the actual kind of Rosetta Stone and not the the language learning thing. This is all about a really cool project that is it NASA or is it another space agency that's involved?
European Space Agency.
Okay, so the European Space Agency is trying to land a probe on a comet, and so there's a lot kind of involved in that because essentially they have to match the speed of the comet and the angle and all that kind of stuff. But also interesting is that they don't just want to observe it; they actually want to land something on it, and it's going to like bolt itself into the comet, so it's transmitting data as the comet kind of flies through through space, and it's just way, way cool.
That's a robot I can support.
Yeah, that's 100%. 100% a thing. I think having a transmitting thing on a comet is really interesting because a comet will fly kind of further closer to the sun and then also further away from the sun than a lot of things get. And it will do both, right? It's not because orbits of comets are extremely elliptical. They're really long and kind of short up and down. So they're not completely circular. They're like really stretched out ovals. And that means, like I was saying, you will get a pass where you're close to the sun and then a pass where you're very far from the sun. So it's more interesting than, say, following like Neptune or, it's maybe not more interesting, but it's more varied than following like a single planet's orbit. We should still kind of do that too. I mean, what we're really trying to say is going to space is still a thing and, putting probes in space, still way cool. I mean, the work involved in landing on a moving target like that is crazy. I mean, the speeds involved are literally astronomical. And you mentioned that there's a live stream about the about landing on it.
They're gonna do a live stream of the landing.
That's fantastic.
Which I believe will be happening at some point, probably tonight.
Okay.
I'm really bad with converting GMT. It's at 8:35 GMT tomorrow. So whatever that is, wherever you are.
8:35 p.m.?
No, a.m.
Oh, so that's 1:30 in the morning here. Because it's 7, right? Because it's standard time now? I think.
That's when it starts. That's when they start separation, uh-huh. And then it takes 7 hours.
7 hours?
Yeah.
Wow. That is a lot of time. Well, I know what I'll be doing this evening. Watching a small rock get closer and closer and closer. It's still really fascinating. I mean, I don't know if it says in the article like how fast comets go, but even just like planets, we're talking like thousands of miles an hour in order to get where they're going and go. So it'll be really interesting. I'm sure there will be a lot of kind of cool stuff that comes about it, and probably a movie or two. We'll see. I mean, if they made a movie out of Armageddon where they land a mining crew on an asteroid, we could maybe get a movie about landing a robot on a comet. We'll see.
I say you don't want to miss a thing, but I'd be fine missing that movie.
Wild. Excellent. Well, I think, you know, we have a little bit of time. I want to make sure I get this posted so people can get the link and watch the live stream of that. And also, again, just reminding folks, if they if you'd like to be on the show, if you'd like to join us for, you know, another trip down memory lane kind of topic-wise, or maybe take it in a different direction, if you have a thing that you like to talk about, we'd love to hear about it. And I'm sure all our other listeners would too. It's been a fun time kind of creating these podcasts, and it's a fun time putting them out in the world. As long as we can put them out in the world, we probably will. So join us if you like. And Brendan, I'll talk to you next week.
Till next time, Alan.